You're listening to The Deceptionists, Truth Through Fiction. On this episode, Jim, Dave, Caroline, and Kelly talk about what happens when you get into a writing cluster.
I know and you know, baby, that we're going through some hard times. But you're my good thing, baby, and I'm still glad that you're mine. Well, I feel so special, darling, when I hear you call my name. We give up on love now, baby, and be a low-down, dirty shame. Well, the love we have now, baby, can still be out of sight. And I won't give up this good thing, no, without a fight. All right.
Folks, a quick note about this episode. The recording actually cut off early, so we still got through the bulk of the episode, and we thought we'd bring it to you anyway, but we do end sort of abruptly in the midst of answering some listener questions, so we do apologize for that, and we'll endeavor to make sure that doesn't happen next time, but one of those technology gaffes that you've got to forgive us every once in a while. Anyway, enjoy the discussion. Thank you very much. Now, without further ado, here's Jim.
You're listening to The Deceptionists, Truth Through Fiction, a frightfully sporadic podcast about the craft of storytelling. We are by storytellers for storytellers looking to bring a sense of community to the solitary pursuit of writing. And nothing can be more solitary in some ways than NaNoWriMo, where we find ourselves right now. I am Jim Rutchkowski. Joining me tonight are Dave Acampo.
Hi.
Caroline Pruitt.
Hello.
And Kelly Stevenson, the inspiration for this week's episode. We're talking about quagmires.
Oh, that's a good one.
Disasters, morasses, literary quicksand, getting stuck, in other words. We had another word for it that you're probably seeing in the title of this episode. Kelly, would you like to talk a little bit about how we got here?
Sure. Well, it's kind of weird because we're recording this on a Thursday, and this will probably go up on a Monday or Tuesday. And the way that the month of November works, if you're doing NaNoWriMo, your attitude and your place, and you go through every stage of the grieving cycle, like, I don't know, every 2 or 3 hours. So who knows where I'll be on Monday.
Right.
I could be, you know, the greatest cheerleader, or I could have completely thrown in the towel. But when we were talking about what we wanted to talk about this week, I was in the middle of my first big NaNoWriMo crisis. I had I cheated this year, actually. I had a story that had 3 chapters already written that I was going to add 50,000 words to and complete by the end of the month. And my problem, I guess this was probably Tuesday, so a few days into the whole thing, was that it just absolutely refused to go where I needed it to go. And if this was any other sort of writing exercise, I could have stopped and taken the time to backtrack and figure out where I got off the rails and fix it, and just sort of throw away the words that I didn't need. But this is NaNoWriMo, and every word is sacred, and one does not edit. So I spent most of Monday just being ridiculously frustrated, and it was this mess because I wanted to tell a very straightforward story, and I kept throwing all of these complications in there, and I, you know, I'm like typing, and it's like, what are you doing? And my other half of my brain would be like, just shut up and keep writing, and it got to be quite the cluster, as it were. So I called my friends and said, hey, why don't we have a group therapy session and you can tell me how to fix this giant cluster and what we should do about that. And that's where I was on Monday. Today, Thursday, I gave in pretty much by the end of the day. Monday, I'd gone through the all the way to acceptance and realized that NaNoWriMo was not going to do the thing I wanted it to do, wherein I wasn't going to finish this story. I wasn't going to get a rough draft of what I wanted to write, and I should just give in. So instead of writing a vaguely medieval, Anglo, whatever, fantasy world with swords and elves and, well, not elves, but swords and people who can do magic and wizards and mages and things. It's now set in some sort of vaguely Victorian Regency steampunk arcane world.
Oh, wow.
That yeah. was quite a shift.
It was really frustrating.
So I'm curious. Now that's a big shift. Do you go back and rewrite the stuff that you already did to get it into this time period, or do you just go forward with notes saying I'm going to go back and change those elves to steampunk people in, you know, whatever?
Yeah, I don't know yet. Well,
or it's really just two disparate novels right now that
No, it works. What happens basically is, so the setup is this is actually the story from our genre show.
Okay.
Where the woman runs the tavern, and at the end of the scene, I think that I read earlier, a guy just sort of like apparates out of nowhere, and then like he's bloody and passes out, right?
Okay.
Yes. So after that scene, in the original novel, well, and in this one sort of, you know, she's patching him up and everything, and he's got all these little doohickey talismans that allow him to jump from place to place because this is part of the magic of the world. And accidentally, the two of them get transported to someplace far away. You know, it's the meet cute, basically. You know how it is. You meet a guy, you accidentally touch a strange figure and say a magic word, and you all get transferred halfway across the world.
Only every other Thursday. Yeah,
yeah, that's why I've been so busy this week.
So the meat of the romance novel was the two of them not getting along at the very beginning and sort of having to work together to overcome all sorts of random obstacles and getting her back home and falling in love in the process. So I had a couple of introductory chapters and basically up to the point where they get transported written before I started NaNoWriMo. And this was all, again, set in, like, you know, we've got corsets and swords and we run taverns and horses and things. So I started writing it and they get halfway across the world and I added all these extra complications that weren't supposed to be there about him. It turns out that he'd stole something and is like on the outs of the place that they ended up showing up. And cause it was a random place and this guy wanted to kill him. And it was just like, what are you doing? Just keep writing the story. And then when she gets out of there, all of a sudden it turned into this Regency thing where she had all of these manners and all of this appropriate dress and everybody was doing all this doublespeak. And it was interesting. I think it was because my Tumblr feed was full of Downton Abbey for a while. And it was just like, you can't, can I do Regency and magic at the same time? And it was like, well, no. And then I thought about it and I'm like, well, I guess if you had a world with magic in, you know, the 1100s, eventually the world would mature and technology would exist. And so the Industrial Revolution would happen and you'd have Regency thing. I need Sigurd on the call to explain how this would actually happen. But so I started thinking about it and it was like, well, if you're going to go that far, and I realized that Regency and Victorian aren't the same and I'm kind of blushing them together, but it's my world. I can do whatever I want.
That's right. But
so I was thinking about it. And I'm like, well, it would be steampunk at that point. And I don't know why I think it would be steampunk at that point, but I feel like if you had magic, once you figured out how to, you know, work with metal a little bit better and invent steam, like you wouldn't just forget about magic and it would change everything. So it's steampunk now.
So this is fascinating to me because your dilemma that you're running into, I mean, what you told us is a pretty classic plot line. You said, you know, there's this sort of two people at odds that, you know, it starts with this sort of meet cute and these two people at odds and they have to work together and eventually maybe they'll fall in love. I mean, that could be set in any environment, right? I mean, it could be steampunk from the beginning. It could be medieval. And so I'm curious about why. And I guess what I'm wondering here is, because you said your Tumblr feed was full of Downton Abbey, I'm wondering if this is a case where when you're doing NaNoWriMo, you kind of pull from everything that's at top of mind. And I'm wondering if you just naturally, like, that's what you creatively gravitate towards because you're like, I've just got to write. And these mannerisms, these sensibilities are keep coming at you. They're what are fresh on your mind. And then you're kind of going, okay, just go with it. Now it's this, you know, or if it's something,
yes.
Or was it something in the plot where you're like, you know what, medieval doesn't, or magic, fantasy, whatever, doesn't work here. It needs to be something else. You know, I'm curious. That's fascinating to me.
Well, there was always supposed to be this sort of fish out of water aspect of her personality, because she lives in a small town, and she, you know, she's pretty much only really experienced the world of her inn. And so that was supposed to set up some sort of preconceived, you know, like the guy's going to think that she doesn't know anything, but the fact is the entire world has come through her doors, so she actually knows a whole lot. She has a lot of practical knowledge, but she has a lot of theoretical knowledge.
But that could still all sit in a fantasy world. I mean, that to me, that's the Hobbit, or, you know, whatever. Like, there's the little Hobbit, and then he goes off and has this big grand adventure.
Absolutely. Yes, my heroine is a Hobbit now. Awesome. Doing this. It just, for some reason, when I made it more, when the scene, like, it sort of came out, and it had all this sort of affectation and people putting on airs, and like he had servants with that were doing a lot of doublespeak with her, and they were on the side because the guy's kind of a douche, but he wasn't supposed to be a douche, but for some reason in this story he's a douche. Maybe there was a, you know, a jerky guy that walked across my path too in the last 6 days, but
maybe I'm just curious.
So you know, it's just kind of like, I think you definitely, you're onto something there with whatever is going on in your life becomes your NaNoWriMo novel. I mean, I was at rehearsal for my chorus on Tuesday, and by the end of it, I was like, I should have a song in there. I should have something, some magic that has to do with singing, because that's really cool. And maybe and it was just like, no, you need to stop. You need to just focus. And like every time somebody says anything all day today, I've been like, I could put that in my, no, you can't, just write.
No, and I think that's a great point. Sorry, Caroline, I'll let you. I just want to say that we've talked about that in the past, where I do that if I go sit and write at a cafe or something. I'm often, if I get stuck, I'm pulling from things around me. And that certainly helps if you're writing in a, you know, like a modern present day literary genre, because that's likely what you're going to be surrounded by. You know, you're not going to be, it doesn't necessarily, you can't pull directly if you're writing something set in a fantasy thing. But, you know, it's not just what's around you, but it's like, you know, any entertainment you're taking in and everything. But for me, it becomes like that. It becomes that sort of puzzle that you're assembling, and you're sort of plucking these pieces out of the air going, well, does that fit? Does that fit? And, you know, in some cases, I think you end up taking a saw to the actual puzzle and going, well, I'm liking this better, so we're just going to carve these pieces to fit. And, you know, I mean, I think that's really cool. And I think that's kind of the idea of NaNoWriMo, is that you don't stop, that you hit those frustrations, and where and any other month that might have stopped you for a month while you sat and thought about it and, you know, did other things and read a book and then eventually come back to it. Here you don't have that, so you have to go through all those stages you mentioned, and then you're just like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going with this. And you know,
The other hand, a fairly important part of this discussion has been left out that I feel honor bound to bring up.
Okay. I bet you do.
Because I received a text from my friend Kelly a few days ago, and in it she said, I wanted to use the challenge of NaNoWriMo to get a fairly workable rough draft of this novel written, but it looks like too many of the side effects of NaNoWriMo are getting in the way of that. Mm. Which is to say, in my words, in Jim's words, NaNoWriMo is bad for your writing. To put it another way, Jim is right.
That is certainly a thesis to explain.
The more that we discussed this privately, the more it sounded like NaNoWriMo was functioning as a treadmill. You use it to work out, but you don't actually get anywhere.
Okay. Well, all right.
Well, I'm going to shift back a little bit, though, to, because I was interested in what Kelly was describing about the book. And this isn't necessarily a counter to the Jim was right thesis.
Yeah, I'm not sure we've given that enough discussion yet. So let's please get back to that soon.
This is a potential spin. It seems like the way that you started writing the story, Kelly, you gave yourself escape hatches. Like you gave your, because it seems like you're like, okay, you have these people who can travel from world to world to world. Well, maybe what you have is a story where you have one incident that takes place in a world that affects you this way. And then when you kind of feel like you've written out of that, it's kind of inception, you know, you can just kind of snap your fingers and you're on a different level and suddenly you've got a different story. It seems like, if the function of NaNoWriMo is if you were going into this hoping you were going to have a finished draft of this discrete novel that you started, it sounds like it's not working for that.
It is not, because Jim is right.
But there's nothing wrong with that treadmill if it's getting you cycling through these ideas. And I mean, it seems like actually for the setup you have, this potentially could be something good because you're going to go forward as far as you can go with this particular idea. But you've also kind of left yourself this back door where you can say, okay, once they've gotten through what's in this universe, maybe I move them over to another one. Maybe I move them over to another one until you figure out what works. So I think
I also think Dave raises an interesting point that the structure of November being what it is, it forces you not to just shelve it until you've come up with a solution, which you never come up with because
I've wanted to back out of this so many times.
Right.
If it wasn't for the fact that I feel like I'm doing this even more publicly than I've done this before, I'd be reading comics and playing.
I totally get that, but I do think there's some value in, you know, and I get Jim, I totally, you know, get your point on this, but at the same time, when I think about the plot structure, I guess my question is, are these two characters progressing in their adventure, regardless of what the setting is, you know, and if so, then Kelly's making progress. You know, if she can get to the end of the story by the end of the month, and she has a story about these two people thrown together, not liking each other, coming to like each other, realizing they love each other, or, you know, some one of them dying or whatever happens, you know, and she gets a complete story, you know, then she's got a complete romance novel. And the easiest thing to do is go back to chapter one and do a find and replace on the word elf, you know, or whatever it is, right? So, I mean, I see like this as a way of maybe she's still finding her novel. Maybe she thought it, and I think there's nothing wrong with starting one way, realizing it's something else that works better for the characters, as long as you're still taking that arc, that, you know, following that story with those characters, and then you can go back and change things as you need to, you know.
In fact, that seems to be all we ever hear. I think we've talked about it on prior shows about the constant cliche that you hear when you're listening to writers talk about writing, and they say, you know, the characters wrote themselves. I wanted to do it this way, but the character just wouldn't let me.
Right.
She had her
right.
own ideas and so on and so
forth.
Well,
and that's actually the problem I have with this heroine specifically. I keep putting her into all these perilous sort of situations, and she doesn't want to be in a romance novel. Like every time I'm like, hey, that guy over there, isn't he cute? Don't you want to, you know, talk about him and think about him for a while? And she's like, I'm halfway across the world looking after a small child. I have no idea who any of these people are. And the only guy that you want me to hook up with is the one that is probably some sort of evil killer. It's like, wait, you're doing it wrong. Yeah, she argues with me a lot. So that's how I know she's a good character.
That's fun, though. Or maybe not, depending on where you are in the NRL.
No, I mean, and that's the thing. This would be awesome any other time. Like, I got to a point that day where I was like, you know what? You're just not going to write that novel right now. It's moving in a far enough away direction that, like, if it starts off kind of the same, if I, you know, in some universe where I write two of these novels, it would be okay. It's going to be different enough that it'll be fine. And she's not a tavern owner anymore, because then I realized that, like, man, you know, if you're like in Victorian England and you own a tavern, like, society's not going to talk to you. You're like, you know, seedy and everything. So now she's a baker. So now she owns a bakery. And that's because I had to make three cakes this weekend I ate three cakes this weekend for my daughter's birthday parties. So, you know, now she bakes things for a living.
Well, there you go.
It's crazy.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you talk about that, I was trying to find a relation to that because, you know, Kelly, obviously you're in the middle of NaNoWriMo and, you know, you're under a lot of stress with that. But when you brought that up, I started thinking about, you know, what happens with me? And I realized I had just gone through a similar sort of stuck moment that manifested itself in a very different way. So in our last episode, I talked about that I'm working on this comic book that we're going to publish next year. It's a 5-issue miniseries, and Jeremy Rogers, my co-writer, and I, we basically plotted it out where we had a long outline. I'd say it was maybe 5 pages or so, and it broke down each chapter and what happens. And so, you know, we basically sold the book on that outline and, you know, 11 pages of sample script. So we're locked into that, but we're still scripting it. So we finished up issue 2, and it's structured very much, it's a horror book, but it's also a crime book, and it's structured very much like a crime book. When we had Jay Stringer on our crime show, we talked a lot about, you know, the character having, starting off with an assumption that may or may not be true, and like a false assumption that the character starts with. You know, Jim's story about the weatherman waking up in the hot tub is a perfect example. You know, he assumes, oh my God, I did this, I better, you know, hide the body or whatever he's going to do. It's a great place to start. So we had a lot of these built in, but we're at the point where we actually have to start executing on the details. And mm-hmm. so we start scripting and we're going like, okay, so, and this is hard. I'm going to try to do this without, you know, in a general sense. So I'm not spoiling anything that eventually, hopefully people are going to buy and read. But you know, it's like, so this character was actually behind this. Okay, great. Who is this guy that we wrote it up really briefly in the outline, but we didn't really expand on it. And why is he doing this? Okay, so why doesn't he just shoot the guy on page one, scene one? You know what? And so we start getting this sort of, okay, wait. And so Jeremy and I send these emails back and forth. And here's the thing, we're locked in. I mean, there are certain things right. we cannot change in the structure of this thing. And 11 pages of it, maybe 15 pages by this time have already been drawn of this thing. So now we have an artist who's going like, you guys can't change that. You know, we're on a deadline and I've got to draw this stuff and do the watercolors for it. And so it's a huge battle of craft. So Kelly, it's not dissimilar to what you're dealing with. There's certain things that I can't change, but we have to make it all work. And so Jeremy and I end up sending these emails back and forth that are as long as the scripts themselves, you know, where we're like, well, wait, if so-and-so works here and they actually do this, then why wouldn't so-and-so? And then the next person writes back and they're saying, oh my God, but then that doesn't make any sense why, you know, character B would even be involved in this in the first place. And so we just were going back and forth, and I had my little clusterfuck moment where I'm thinking, oh my God, what if we can't fix this? People are going to read it and see the holes in it, and they're going to realize that certain things happen out of convenience, and we're going to be laughed out of the comic book industry.
And this is why all of my novels stay on my hard drive. Right. I don't have to worry about any of that stuff because it freaks me out too.
Now, to the positive note on that is that we really had to stop and step back, go back to our original outline, and really think about, okay, what is the core that has to happen here? What are the things we know we can't change? And what do the characters really want? Because there are certain things that we have not written yet, that have not been drawn yet. We can still change those. So I started to think of it almost like a sculpture where some of it is hardened to stone and some of it is still clay. And you can sort of manipulate it, you know, in certain places, but then others you can't. You have to, you know, you can't really move it around. And, you know, eventually by just really focusing in on, here's the main story, what it's about. This is the protagonist. This is what he's going through. This is where he has to be at the end of it. What's the simplest way to get that across? Let's not confuse it. And we ended up coming back to a plot that's very similar to our original thing. We had just, in the process of trying to give it texture and trying to give it depth and trying to flesh out each character's dimensions, we started playing with them and taking them in directions that seemed cool but didn't benefit the story. And so we had to really pull it back in. And honestly, if I were writing this alone, and this, I know I always talk about co-writing here, but I needed somebody to go back and forth with and argue back and forth on what would work and what wouldn't. And what we ended up with, again, is scaling it back to, you know, kind of what we had originally, but we knew better and we had actually written a couple scenes in the meantime, you know, for down the road, like, you know, oh, but we can still do this now that we had thought about. And so we actually came out of it, you know, very similar to where to the way you did, where you're sort of resigned yourself to it and went like, okay, I'm just going to go with it and do it. You know, we've kind of come to the same place where we're like, okay, we figured it out, it works, and now we're moving forward again.
One of the things that I've noticed when you find, because I have had those moments where I've been very close to having something that I had to turn in or something like that, and I was like, oh crud, here's this logical inconsistency, and I flipped out about it. I was like, oh my gosh. Try running it by like four different people who haven't been looking at the story for you know, a month solid, and see if they even notice what the hell it is you're freaked out about.
Right.
Now,
right.
I mean, there are some times where it really is something you have to change, but there's sometimes it's the instant panic reaction, and then I've you know, I've left something and gone back and I've been like, oh, A, either that would have been really easy to fix, or B, nobody was going to notice that except me.
And I guarantee you some of the stuff that I'm referring to, people wouldn't have noticed, you know, because it's just kind of stuff that you see in movies all the time, you know, and but someone picks it out and someone goes, well, you know, that character, you know, whatever. And they have a problem with it. But in this case, if Jeremy and I could see it, I feel it's our duty to fix it if we can, to make sure that it doesn't. So yeah, I guarantee you some of it wouldn't have even have been noticed, but I wanted this thing to be, you know, as tight as I could possibly make it. I wanted everything to make sense. And, you know, we even had a discussion where one of us was saying, like, well, so-and-so is really just a plot device to move this forward. And I said, but I have to know why she chooses to do. That's not good enough. I need to believe it, you know? And I think it made our stuff stronger for it.
Yeah, that's actually one of the problems I'm having right now with my novel, is I keep introducing these tertiary characters and I have to give them enough backstory to be able to hear them. And then suddenly it's like, well, let's just go talk about them for, you know, it's just like, no, if they get their own book later if you need to do that. But right now they just need to sit in the room and say the three things that need to be said to get you out of this scene.
I see. Yeah.
In all the years that I've heard people talk about having someone else look over your work and another set of eyes, I've never heard anyone say, maybe they won't notice the problems. And that's a good reason to have them do it too. I've heard a lot of, like, maybe they'll notice something that you didn't because you've looked at it 100 times, but nobody's ever before today said, maybe because you've looked at it 100 times, you're obsessing over something that doesn't matter at all.
Right. Or readers will fill in their own gap. I mean, how many times have you gone to a movie and someone says, well, that wasn't explained very well. And you say, well, you know, I just figured it was this. And it's not stated explicitly, but you've sort of filled in the gap yourself. I think a lot of us, I certainly do that. You know, I'll give stories the benefit of the doubt if I can fill it in easily with my own imagination. You know, well, maybe he worked an all-night shift that night. And then that's the explanation for it, you know.
Maybe Batman really knew what he was doing when he jumped out of the window and left the Joker in the party with those people. that's a whole tangent.
That's something I've never wondered about before.
Now you have.
Now you're right. But the chase scene afterwards, where the Joker just happens to magically anticipate every random thing that the Batman does in the middle of that chase scene. Yeah, that one he totally had plotted out.
The dirty little secret about the Joker in that movie, just as long as we're on a tangent, is that he's a liar and a hypocrite who talks about being an agent of chaos who could only do the things that he's done if he's meticulously planned every possible outcome.
How I feel about that movie.
Yes. But there's nothing saying that he can't be a liar and a hypocrite. He's already a nut bar. Why not?
There you go. See, you filled in the gap yourself.
That's right. Exactly.
But now we think that's weak storytelling because we as the audience had to sort of fix the flaws for it. I think there's a difference between leaving some things up to the reader's imagination and this is weak storytelling, but I'm going to help it along and try to fix it.
Right. Well, yeah, I think it's a matter of scale. You know, something like that maybe is a bigger example. If it's something like we didn't explain why he wasn't home that night or something, somebody can fill in something small like that themselves, you know? So I guess in that case, you're right. It's just a matter of scale, you know? If it affects the overall plot and themes and everything, then yeah, that may be sort of an issue. But I mean, I think our goal is to try and make it as tight as possible. The idea is that every character, even your little tertiary characters, you hopefully know that they're there for a reason and they have their own story going into that. Even if they're only appearing to say those three things and leave, I mean, at least me personally, I like to at least think about, okay, why are they there? What are they doing? What are they trying to get out of this? You know, even if it doesn't make it onto the page, because I think that helps me feel how these events are intersecting and sending people off in different directions.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the flip side of that is a lot of times that's the stuff I end up editing out. Like, I'm like, I go through it. I'm like, crud, something needs to be here to explain this. I write like 5 paragraphs to explain something. In the second draft, that gets to be like a sentence and a half. But I mean, I'm still glad that I did the mental work on it. But I realize that that's perhaps through – through the second reader telling me, I don't understand why you spent six paragraphs explaining
right.
why she was home to take the phone call when you could have just cut from, you know, her being at work to her being wherever else. So I don't remember on the point of not getting, I think we're talking specifically about getting stuck because of being hung up on a particular logical point, right?
Right.
Right. Now, and actually that raises a question. Kelly, we haven't really talked about this. You've talked about being stuck and realizing that this was a Regency romance. I'm not well versed enough in the genre to know exactly what that means. Why couldn't this have stayed the fantasy that it was to begin with? What about it eliminated the possibility of, elves and fairies and so on?
To start off with, it wasn't like full-blown elf and fairy dragon fantasy. It was more just kind of sort of a Game of Thrones level of, you know, we're medieval. There just happens to also be this kind of elemental magic thing that people can do. But everybody's people. There's no other races or anything. It just was. Like, I know it's a weird thing to say, but I was writing it and it was like their costumes changed in my mind as I was describing the scene. And I purposefully wanted to sort of express how far away she was from home, how out of her element she was, because the story takes place in the fall. It's actually the beginning of the harvest season, but then she's in this sort of, when she gets teleported, she's in this room and there's no outside influence. Like, there's no window. She can't tell what the temperature is. And so it doesn't really hit her that she's someplace completely and totally foreign until she steps outside. And it's this, like, you know, pavilion, and there's a huge courtyard in the middle, and it's this kind of Roman architecture. And it's summer, it's hot there because she traveled to someplace that that doesn't have winter. And once I did that, once I sort of kicked her out of that rural area or rural place, it just, the whole thing just shifted. I mean, everybody, it's like a dream. When you're in one setting and all of a sudden everything just kind of melts and you're someplace different. It just was.
Do you think that it's just the affectation? Like, it's just what you wanted to write in that moment? I wanted to write characters who speak a certain way or who dress a certain way? Or was it something, do you think, necessary to her character? That, like, no, a medieval setting wouldn't work here because it just doesn't, it doesn't get put her far enough out of her element, or it's, I can't create that, that world doesn't work here anymore.
I'm not exactly sure. I know that it started changing after the douchebag lord. I gave him a lord title because I couldn't come up with any other, you know, fancy title, so I just stuck lord in there. He sort of passes her off to his servants. And again, like, the vocabulary that I just started using because I didn't have time to come up with better vocabulary was all very upstairs, downstairs. It was the maid and the head of the house, and he had he still had like guards and things, but it all of a sudden became the sort of very domestic Downton Abbey upstairs, downstairs thing. And that it added an interesting element. I mean, it was really fun, actually. It was easy to write the scenes where she's learning about the culture that she's gone into, and, you know, the maids trying to sort of warn her against certain things without being too forward. And it was interesting stuff to write that night at 11, or actually that may have been a 5 a.m. one. we said before we started how exhausted I am. I've been getting up at 5 to write and going to bed at like 11, and that's never enough sleep for me. Yeah, this has been an interesting stamina challenge, if anything else. One of these days I'm just going to crash and sleep for 15 hours. But anyway, so it was a thing, and it came really easily to write it, and I got to write all these lush descriptions about the room she was in and the way people looked at her and all the pretty clothes, and it was fun. And then suddenly, like, the next time I sat down with it, I'm like, where did you go? You went someplace completely, and you can't undo it because it's NaNoWriMo, and yeah.
I will say that especially for something like this, it's going to be really time intensive. This is what was most fun for me to write, is a perfectly valid reason for a change, I think, because and even if you're not on a sort of tight, condensed deadline like Nano, if you're going to spend a lot of time in this world, you want to like it. And so if, you know, if the one where you felt that you felt like you should have done and the one that you might have put all this work into creating just wasn't clicking for you right then I think going to the one that is really calling to your imagination at the time is that's a way to get unstuck, certainly.
Absolutely.
And what's weird is I don't even know what steampunk is. Like, I know it's a word. I've seen a lot of pretty costumes from various Tumblr, but like, I've never written anything in steampunk. I've never read anything. The closest I got is a video game that has some steampunk elements in it. And it was just like, and that was part of my problem earlier this week. It was like, you cannot be 12,000 words into a NaNoWriMo assignment and invent a new world. Like, you do not have that luxury today. And it was like, that's too bad. So it's like every once in a while, I start saying weapon and I'm like, he probably has a gun. You should use this gun. Later you can go back and describe how it's made of like arcane magic bullets or something, but like use different words now. It's really strange.
There's
a lot more leather.
I come back to, as long as the characters are moving, you know, forward and they're coming to some kind of, or, you know, hitting their conflict and coming to some kind of resolution, I think you're fine. I mean, I think that's kind of cool that you, I mean, first of all, you could actually invent a whole new genre. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, a whole new blend of steampunk and medieval. Find your own world, you know? There are no rules.
That was the thing. I was like, do we do steampunk with magic or do we do steampunk because it's not magic?
Why the hell not?
I don't know. Because who's going to read it if they don't already know it, I guess.
I think there's more crossover there than you might think.
Although I will say a lot of people, not a lot, but like the few people that I've talked to about this, that I'm like, it started out medieval and now it's all Victorian steampunk. People have been like, ooh, that sounds cool. And it was like, well, that's good.
I guess. I mean, you know, it struck me that like, okay, look, you know, as long as those characters make it through their journey, like I said before, it's easy to go back and just change the beginning parts and make it fit in with that world more. Or, you know, like Caroline kind of indicated that she's going from a medieval world into a steampunk world, and maybe it's a sort of Sliders parallel universes kind of adventure story.
Yeah,
you know?
That's a little out there for this story.
Well, maybe it's not, but that's the thing is you can decide all that later. You know, I mean, the thing is to keep your characters going, and if you're in a steampunk thing and you realize, hey, you know what, this is a magic steampunk thing, I say own it, go for it, and then figure out the laws of that world later after November's over. Or obviously as you need to, but you know, if you can keep the characters going through it, you know, add magic, and then later, you know, you can kind of figure out, okay, so this is how that world works altogether, and then smooth it out in the revision and make sure it works. But you have your characters, you have them going through their journey and coming to that conclusion, and so, you know, you've successfully written a story.
Yeah, I think, and this goes back to the way my process is, like, if I don't dress the set, then they're performing on a blank stage, and I'm not sure that it connects to anything. Real is not exactly the right word because it's a made-up Victorian steampunk magical world, but like, it just, if I don't have a setting for them to explore whatever it is that they're going to end up exploring by the end of it, like it's going to feel like Mad Libs to me, and won't feel as genuine. I know I'm going to have to go through and figure out some stuff, and I do have those three sort of blank chapters at the beginning where it's, you know, set up her relationship in her town, set up the guy showing up, and set up the jump to the new world, new place. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to go back at some point, and I'm sure I'll hit a roadblock later on and you know, probably change the story again. Who knows?
I guess that is the danger, because if you are working on a blank slate, you can do all the character work you want, but if it's devoid of the environment, you're really robbing yourself of the way that any kind of genre like that, like a fantasy world, works best when the environment is part of what makes the characters act the way they do. I mean, maybe it's something about the wildness or the mystery of a Middle Earth type of world that actually plays to the characters. And so, you know, you can't separate them out and say, well, now they're a quest, but they're, you know, going on a blank, you know, sheet of paper somewhere and they're doing something. I mean, that's a good point, is that writing, there is a danger in writing devoid of environment. But what I like that you're doing is you're creating the environment that suits you, you know, because, oh, I need to keep writing. Well, this is going to be the environment, and you're finding a way that works. And then I guess I'm kind of hoping that it will all gel as you go along and you can, you know, make it all the way to the conclusion.
Yeah, can I say something that's actually the exact opposite of that?
Great.
Well, no, this is just an example because this has happened to me, and this is a little bit different than the idea of getting stuck on something, but it's something that I've done in the last month that's maybe how to do a particular thing without getting stuck, which is I had this really strong idea for a fairly short story where I knew the exact beats and I knew the character dynamic I wanted. I knew what kind of basically moral dilemma I want these people to have. And I know, and because of the nature of it, I know it wasn't going to be a realistic story. It had to have some sci-fi fantasy element. I still don't know what that is. So what I did was basically outline, excuse me, I gave the characters kind of generic names. I outlined the story. And I talked over with Sigrid a little bit, like worked out what the beats are. I have that outline now. I'm saving it. I have it on ice for a while, and because I've been trying to do some short fiction reading, like in sci-fi and fantasy. So I'm kind of looking now for the dress that I want to put on that story, because I felt like I couldn't. I feel like whatever kind of world it's going to fit in is going to, the world that I need for it is going to be related to what the specific moral stakes are in the story. So this sounds very vague,
right?
But I think it's interesting that you sort of think about what you guys were saying about the story growing out of the world. And I think I'm very much more inclined to put together the abstract story beats and then figure out what I wanted to put it in later. But that does not work certainly for something like NaNoWriMo. That works for something that I write now and like, okay, like in April when I'm done with everything I'm working on now, I'm going to look back at this and figure out what I want to do with it.
Right. Well, I think it's not totally, they're not totally opposite positions, because in a way you already know that there's, like, for instance, you know that this cannot be set in 2011 in our world. You've established that there's something there. So you are already saying that there needs to be something in the environment. Now you're going to create that thing later, but it is characters acting in an environment that is conducive to that story. So I see that as well. I mean, and I wasn't necessarily saying that the story grows out of the world. I was just thinking that, you know, the motivations can be, you know, maybe it can go either way. You know, you can create the world after, but, and it seems to be sort of hand in hand in what Kelly's doing. She's sort of got her characters going through something, and the world is sort of, like she said, a dream. It's sort of just raising up Inception style around her as she needs it to. Like, oh, now it's pillars, and now it's, you know, this, and now it's that, and it's whatever's working for the you know, creating the scenes as it goes. So, you know, I mean, yeah, maybe she's doing that. It's kind of figuring out the world as she goes. I'm just thinking that, you know, I could see someone plotting out an entire adventure story without any environment. Well, you know, character X goes to another land and they find an object, but it's protected by this. And that sort of, to me, is a little dangerous, because you lose a certain richness. You have to, somewhere you have to go in and you have to, in the execution, you have to figure out, you know, exactly why this character is doing this. And it probably has something to do with the way the world operates. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Filling in those details is how I actually got into trouble with this novel. I knew that the hero of the story had a relationship with whoever basically finds them once they get teleported halfway across the world, and that they have a rivalry, and that the heroine sort of gets caught in the middle of this rivalry, and that was always sort of part of the plot, because if there's no other guy around to sort of, like, I don't know, call her attention or call his attention to her being attractive, then it's just an easy thing to put in there. But when I started figuring out what the relationship was, it got so complicated. there's a sister and just all sorts of just crazy stuff. And that's when it it shifted because instead of it being the sort of straightforward, well, they just know each other and they're kind of friends that travel in the same circle, I wanted to raise the stakes, and I kept raising the stakes to the point where it went somewhere else.
But I think heavy. as you built that out, you know, you're finding texture and stuff in that, like that whole complication. I mean, I think getting complicated is good for writing, right? I mean,
yeah.
To complicate your situation with your characters creates more obstacles for them. It maybe gives you, maybe you're creating your path as you're going there, finding, you know, the obstacles that you might throw in the character's way as you go along.
I mean, I think that's why I have a hard time writing short stories, and all of my world thoughts are these, you know, big giant epic things. Whether they get finished, that's what it feels like inside of my head. And I was hoping that the romance novel aspect of this would keep it more straightforward, since there is that pretty specific path that a story takes. I don't want to talk about too much about how great this is, because then that also sounds like maybe Jim wasn't so right.
Yeah, we don't want to lose focus.
So Kelly
benefits.
Oh, go ahead.
But yeah, I mean, I dig where I'm going. I just, oh my goodness, it was rough a couple of days ago.
I'm sure
it'll be rough again in a few days.
I would say, do you have an idea at this point, at the end of the month, do you feel like you're going to be like, thank God I'm done with this and now I can go back to the original idea, or what?
I don't know. I think it's going to depend on how interesting the world is that I create. Because, I mean, like I've said, I've never really experimented with this level of technology and magic and these clothes, which I know sounds weird, but...
No, it's totally steampunk.
So it could be that, yeah, I'll just start hanging out here for a while. I could take... Because, I mean, this is a girl with five sisters originally, and each one of them had their own sort of romance novel all kind of interwoven in the original world that I created. So, you know, I could actually bring them all up to this world and see what happens. Because, I mean, I think that would be interesting. I think it might be interesting. I do know that by the end of this month, I won't want to look at or think of any of these characters for a few months.
Right.
Right.
But that's one of those nasty side effects of NaNoWriMo that Jim's always warning us about, because he's so right.
So Jim, what do you think you should do when you get stuck?
Well, to be honest, most of I've certainly gotten stuck a lot in November myself. In my case, it is in the classic sort of digital equivalent of the waste paper basket that's full of crumpled up pieces of paper. You know, I get a few lines in, and I find that I can remember what it, like, oh, I know what I'm ripping off here, or, you know, this is going nowhere, or this is the kind of Romana Clef I don't want to write this month, and so I end up getting nowhere. Now, in the case of like the kind of stumbling block that Kelly's talking about, I don't know if I have any better advice than the advice that I hear all the time from everyone else, is that, you know, just put fingers on the keys, you know, and that's what the point of the NaNoWriMo exercise is supposed to be, I guess. My only concern with it has always been that, you know, you don't end up with anything that you can show to anyone else, and I just feel like if you're not doing it with the end goal of showing it to someone else, then you shouldn't be doing it at all. So I guess my advice or my approach to what happens when you get stuck is to break the rules and edit your brains out. You know, I've never been shy about revisiting the same line of text 20 times. You know, I guess you kind of have to approach it like any other problem you face. You know, you kind of ask, why is this happening and what is the route around it?
I think that's fair. Right. Do we want to take some of the Twitter questions?
Yeah, definitely. We put that question out there on Twitter, and there were some interesting responses. Some were kind of comments and some were questions. So I think we definitely should.
And so I think this is kind of building into a more sort of general discussion of this, and not just necessarily NaNo related. We have Bob? Do we think that's Uke Bob? Justin Fraser says, do you ever cut and run from a story, maybe come back later with a different perspective, or do you just focus until finished? And so I think this is something that's not really an option necessarily with Nano, but just in sort of a bigger sense.
Right.
Cutting and running from a story and come back to it later, or is it better just to work through it?
I think, you know, this is a, I thought about this when this is a fascinating question, and it made me wonder. I said, you know what? If I don't set deadlines or have to turn things into people, I wonder if I would ever finish a story. I definitely have cut and run from stories. There are a lot of times where I've come back to it later, yes. But there are other stories that just die on the vine, you know? They just sort of wither and die, and I leave them behind, and I don't come back to them. You know, maybe one day I will, but I think definitely the ones that I've finished very often, I owe them to somebody. Either I have a co-writer that I'm, you know, responding to. I've set up a writing team and they have deadlines and I have a deadline, or I'm turning it into somebody. One of our guests on the show, Sarah Kuhn, I'm going to lose the name of it. Grok. They do an online e-zine called Grok that Caroline, I think you wrote for in one issue, as did I. And they sort of sent around a theme, and the theme was Avatar. And so, not the movie Avatar, but, you know, like the icon on your computer representing yourself. And so, this was a case where I actually thought about that, and then I pitched an idea for a story. So very similar to my earlier tale about, you know, running into problems with my current comic book script, is that I pitched a whole story that had sort of a Twilight Zone twist to it. And it's one of the first times I had really done something like that, like written a whole pitch and then been forced to write it and stick to it. And I knew that I owed it. I knew I had to make it work. In my mind, the pitch worked. But there's that scary part in roughly about the middle of any story, whether long or short, you know, maybe it comes sooner in a long one, but, you know, that you just have that terror that it absolutely does not work, that the pitch that you based this all on is completely flawed. And, you know, if you owe it to somebody and you already sold them on this idea, then you have to slog it out and hope that you're right. Mm-hmm. But that terror is very real, and there's no way around it other than to just really tighten it up and make sure and keep working on it until you have what you think is, you know, something that works.
It's
and the terror, I'm sorry, I think the terror of powering through is that what if I'm going down into some random cul-de-sac and by the time I realize how far I've gone off the beaten path, there's no way back.
Exactly, yeah.
Fortunately, with things that are deadline-driven, there's some kind of finite nature with either you're gonna get something into it or you're going to fail, and it depends on whether you enjoy the sensation of quitting and disappointing people, or whether you know. Which sometimes I do. I've been in the situation where, like, by the time I'm like, you know what, I don't like the person I told I was going to submit this to anymore. I should not be advertising this aspect of my of my. So I think you're right. I mean, there's definitely the fear of going down the wrong path. And I think if I had like a book, I can't imagine the stress that would be involved in that. If it was like a book deadline, you know, if it's something that's fairly short and finite, it's at least going to be over. And then it'll be over.
And I think that may be part of the idea of NaNoWriMo is that you don't have time, that terror, you don't have time to deal with it. You have to put it on the back burner and you have to power through, you know, and at least it gets you through the draft, you know. So because that's where I think a lot of people just sort of cut and they let it, you know, they let it go for a little while. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, nobody ever comes back to it.
Yeah, that's the more I think about this question, because my instinct to answer this question was to say, oh yeah, you just leave it and you know you'll get back to it when you have time. Realistically, I don't do that very often. Most of the things I finished, whether it was a school deadline or like something like Grok or something else that I had to do, then the times that I've finished something I was satisfied with, it's when I've just been like, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm just going to keep working until it works.
Right.
And
right.
I'm thinking of a few things where a lot of times for me, it is finding the beginning of the story, because I will write and write and write all this stuff And then I can tell it's not real. This isn't really the story. This is, you know, a lot of random things that could happen in this story, but they're not going to be it. And I had one recently that I just kept writing these scenes, and I totally knew what I needed to happen. I knew what I needed to happen for the character. And I had like a sort of, and I just couldn't figure out how the scenes went together. And I had a side reference to her trying to write a letter to somebody. And so then I just kind of sat down and said, okay, I'll write the letter. And it ended up being an epistolary story because I'm like, okay, because the way that I could channel all the stuff I was trying to say was to put it in her eyes and her words and how she would write it. And that was the kind of thing that I had, like, almost anything I've done that's kind of a gimmick story, that wasn't what the pitch was. I just had to keep going it until I sort of found the hook for it. Right. So that's kind of an example.
And I just want to add that I think there's two levels here, is that when we're saying focus and fit until it's finished, for me, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm at the keyboard until it's done. It means that I'm not giving up on the story till it's done, but that doesn't mean that there are times when I get sort of stuck that I have to step away. And I know we've talked about this before. This is where you go and you wash the dishes, or you vacuum the floor, or you go for a walk, and then you're just thinking about the story in the back of your mind. Or sometimes you can do a lot of by stepping away from the keyboard. But I think what we're talking about is that sort of macro level. We're not giving up on that story. We're just stepping away from it for a few minutes, but that deadline still looms.
And then we have a question from Julia Mazzell, who's one of our loyal listeners. I think this is a really interesting one. How do you get your characters to move? When I'm really stuck, I resort to mostly dialogue and exposition. So I guess she's asking about, you know, writing sort of physical action scenes.
Yeah, this was a fascinating question to me. And Julia had talked about this on Twitter, I think, with us, Caroline, with us a couple weeks back, where she was talking about action specifically. But that idea of movement really made me think about this question probably deeper than she means it. And I don't know, so I hope I don't get this wrong, Julia. But I was fascinated by this because there's a couple things going on there. Is when she's saying that, like, she wants them to stop talking, you know, like, there's too, like, I'm relying on dialogue and the characters aren't moving. I was thinking, well, but the dialogue is moving, right? I mean, we're moving the story forward. I mean, you can write a whole short story or anything with characters just talking. And I realize that I tend to think of dialogue as something that characters do to each other, because there's something that you want, there's something you're trying to get, you're doing to each other, something to each other in a way. But then I thought, you know, does that mean that if she's relying on dialogue, is it because are you not having trouble diving deeper into the characters, like they're talking in circles, or they're having like a surface conversation about, I don't know, movies like we might have in the real world? You know, and so, you know, is there an underlying thing that has to happen to cause them to move? So I started thinking about, what does that mean to move? Like, are we talking about literal choreography? Like, there's an ashtray and she's smoking a cigarette. That's a movement. Or you know, is a guy there with a girl and he's trying to impress the girl? So he's, you know, maybe he's doing something, maybe fumbles and spills water on someone else. And then that guy is an angry guy. And now you have action, you have movement, because something's going to happen there. And it's all based on the characters and their desires, but, you know, and obstacles that they might hit. But you're sort of the movement comes from the actions. I mean, I guess I tend to think of, like, if two people are having a dialogue, they want something from each other. And I think, what happens when, like, an argument gets heated, you know? And what happens, like, have you had that fight with either a parent or a sibling or a loved one, you know, where you end up, you know, punching the wall because you're just so mad, or you just throw something across the room, or, you know, whatever, you know? And then is that the kind of movement that we're talking about, you know, when, like, it transition from dialogue to that? I mean, Caroline, how did you interpret that question?
Well, I was thinking about, because I mean, I like to write a lot of dialogue and exposition too, but I do think if you have a sense that there should be something more physically going on in the story, that's probably a good instinct. And so the thing that I had thought of is, like, maybe brainstorm a list of activities that the characters could be doing, even if they could still be talking while they're doing the thing.
Right.
But some kind of like, so the action is in some way going to move you forward. So, or even just say, okay, I'm going to, what are five things that this character could do that would be revealing about them that would not involve talking? You know, if your problem is that you feel like the story is too talky. Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's where our conversation cut off. We continued to answer that question. I believe that may have been the last question. There may have been one more. If so, I apologize. And after that, we talked about the projects we were working on. Caroline talked about a writing camp. Kelly talked about NaNoWriMo, of course. And I talked about my Kickstarter campaign, which at the time was $3,000 and some odd into the campaign at the time of this edit. We have actually completed the campaign. We reached our $4,000 goal, so anyone who tuned in last time and heard my appeal and went and pledged, I truly thank you from the bottom of my heart. Appreciate it. There are still 9 days left in the campaign, and there are still some great pledge rewards, so if you haven't yet, you can still donate to the cause while picking up some great books. There's some Hermes Press hardcover books that I didn't even realize that we had, so I added those. If you haven't pledged yet, please go and check it out and see if you'd like to pledge to the cause. The other thing we talked about was our change in format. Well, not really format, our change in interval. We decided that rather than a fortnightly or so podcast, which we were getting really bad at, we just decided to move it to a monthly podcast where we're going to record in the middle of the month each month. And we figure with the four of us mostly on every podcast right now, that's just a better interval, better way for us to work. And so, you know, hopefully you guys will tune in every month and hear the next installment of The Deceptionists. And, of course, we ended with our usual stuff, including screwing up which order we were going to say our names and all that good stuff. But you'll just have to listen to a previous podcast for that. I will say that you can find us at thedeceptionist.org. You can leave us comments there on that website. We, you know, post the shows and you can put comments under each show. You can also go to iTunes and leave us a review there. That's very helpful for us. In addition, you can find us on Facebook. If you search Deceptionists on Facebook, I'm pretty sure we're the only thing that's going to come up. But I believe it's facebook.com/thedeceptionists or deceptionists. But again, a search will probably get you. On Twitter, we are Deceptionists. There's no the. That would be too long. So just at Deceptionists. If you want to follow us on Twitter, where we talk about, and we often solicit questions from the audience on Twitter. So that's a good place to follow us. You can send us an email at contact@thedeceptionist.org. We do like our emails. Let us know how we're doing. And that's it. I'm not sure what we're going to talk about next time, but we've got a few weeks to figure it out. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and hopefully there will be no recording snafus next time around. And we will see you all then. Bye-bye.
If I fall short, if I don't make the grade, if your expectations aren't met in me today, there's always tomorrow or tomorrow night hanging there, baby. Sooner or later, I know I'll get it right. Please don't give up on me. Oh, please don't give up on me. I know it's late.